I found that one of the consequences of making this both a video and a podcast is I'm having to perform for two different mediums. And first of all, like if I show anything on the video, like a book cover, I have to remember to always say what it is, which I didn't during the when I interviewed Ryan Price, and I mentioned that in the show notes, the book Gödel, Escher, Bach. Another example I just thought of today is that for a podcast, I think it feels much more natural to just simply start talking at the beginning, especially since I have intro music. But for a video, that feels kind of odd. It feels like I need to do some big welcome. And here's a little bit of tech trivia for you. Alexander Graham Bell originally suggested that when people answered the phone, that they say ahoy. So if you ever want to be a little bit more faithful to the origin of the telephone, next time you answer a call, say ahoy. So with that said, welcome back to my podcast / video / whatever this is. For now, at least it will be both podcast and video, since that's kind of how I started. But maybe in the future, it will just be a podcast. We'll see. So this is Epistemology. Last time, or Epistemology with Robert. Last time we talked about Black Swan, The Black Swan by Nassim Taleb. And I said in this next episode, I wanted to do a little bit of an exercise based on the foundations for my own Christian belief, because I think that's one area where I saw a clear change, a dramatic change, really, in the foundation for my belief. And the change really came before I read Black Swan or anything like that, but Black Swan simply shored up the approach I was taking and made me really commit to that even more. So, to describe how my faith evolved, in particular how the foundations for it intellectually, I think you can kind of describe it the same way most Christians, particularly on the more conservative end, start out with their faith, which is everything is kind of at an equal level within the faith. All beliefs are kind of equally weighted. And a big part of that is the Bible itself, and it being inspired, and it being often, usually in conservative circles, it being inerrant. Inerrant simply means without error. And so that's held at the same level as Jesus having existed, Jesus resurrecting, God existing. It's kind of just this whole package deal. The problem is, as if you want to hold your religious belief or whatever belief as you grow up, if you want to hold whatever worldview you have and also take in the data of the world, then you're going to have clearly you're going to have to start weighing things and start comparing things. And if you're holding to the idea that this book, the Bible, has to be perfect and inspired, then that means as you take in more data, you have so much to compare and investigate. If you want to merge, if you want to truly take into account outside data, which I do, and part of it is interest, part of it is wanting to engage with skeptics, so that's another reason I need to take in that outside data, outside the Bible. A huge part is simply I'm a curious, I've a philosophical person. I've always been that way. And a third thing is simply what field you go into, studying science in school, origin of religions, stuff like that, comparative religions. So basically, quickly it becomes this impossible task if you want to be someone who has intellectually investigated your own faith and also engage with outside data, because the amount of knowledge that you would need is insurmountable. You would need to know science for the parts of the Bible that seem to make scientific claims, if there are some, that's debatable, at least somewhat. You need to know ancient history, you need to know textual criticism, all the different ways texts are developed over time, and oral histories. And you need to know, you really need to be able to defend morally parts of the Bible, because obviously there's a lot in the Old Testament that is like WTF, either just weird or potentially morally objectionable. And this is especially true in the internet globalized age, where you can't really exist as a Christian for very long without your views being challenged. And I mean, in a sense, you can't exist as anything very long without seeing some sort of challenge to those views. So if you're trying to be like me and want to have an intellectual foundation and to you're seeking the truth, then you run up against this wall of like, I can't learn all these things. I can't get a PhD in textual criticism and ancient history and astronomy so that I can kind of shore up my entire Christian views. So you have to narrow things down. So the problem is, obviously, most people don't get that far in their thinking, and that's fine. Like, obviously, this is kind of a hobby for me. This is something that became a huge deal for me, and it's just who I am. I want to look into the foundations of these things. And if you do, then you run into this problem. So there's kind of two approaches. The first one is this feeling that the Bible needs to be exactly as conservative Christians believe it, and it's a total package deal. And that is from, you can either have a kind of a naive take, and which is you can sort of avoid the parts that are the hardest to explain. You can sort of explain away some things. You can study just enough to feel comfortable in some areas and then hope the rest turns out okay. But when you add in the ideas that you get from a book like Black Swan, you are doing the exact opposite of what you should be doing epistemologically. Because the Black Swan ideas, to recap, is you want to assume as less knowledge as possible, as little knowledge as possible. So when a core part of the foundation of your worldview is this massive old book is perfect in every way, you're having to assume an incredible amount of knowledge. All the fields I mentioned before, astronomy, ancient history, whatever. And so not only are you assuming a ton of knowledge, but you are also, it's not very secure knowledge, because you don't know the details of those fields, and it's actively challenged by skeptics and others. So it's really the opposite of a black swan technique. And I remember growing up and starting to think about these things and investigate, it just felt like this weight, this cloud gathering around me. And really what it felt like is just juggling, like all the spinning plates sort of idea. It just felt like I'm patching up this part, and then I'm going to run over here and try to patch up this part and maybe find an answer here. But it just starts to feel like, okay, this is not going to work long term, and I can't spend all my time investigating geology to figure out if the flood could have been global. It's impossible if you want to have a secure understanding of the external data and know if it matches up with what's in the Bible. So there's an entirely separate approach that almost all Christian apologists take that I know of, and that I immediately took when I realized it was an option, which is you kind of forget all that stuff. You completely remove the Bible as anything more than a collection of ancient writings. You completely remove it from a foundation of your belief. It no longer becomes a foundation. And instead, you really just go to the New Testament, and you treat the New Testament as ancient documents, just like Josephus or who are some others, Suetonius. I'm going to naturally mention ones from studies relevant to historical Jesus studies, because that's what I'm familiar with, but Plutarch, So you treat them, or Homer, or something like that. So you treat them all like that, just as generic, non-inspired pieces of writing. And then it really comes down to Jesus. So what I'm presenting now is a much more Black Swan conducive approach, which is something that assumes far less knowledge and far less controverted knowledge, something that is much more secure. So this approach would take the New Testament as simply ancient documents, no more, no less, and then use some of the key facts we can get from them to build a case for Christianity. So Gary Habermas is a Christian scholar, and he kind of pioneered this approach, or made it, he took it to its greatest extent, and he calls it the minimal facts approach. And William Lane Craig, another prominent Christian apologist, does a similar thing, and plenty of other apologists do too. So what they do is they take a handful of what you could call facts of ancient history. And the reason why you can call them facts is because these are things that 90 to 95% of ancient historians accept to be true. And this includes Christian, Jewish, atheist, everything. So here's a really good example. Probably the most secure fact is that Jesus was crucified, died on the cross. Almost no one disputes that. The fact that Jesus existed, too, sometimes you'll hear from skeptics that, oh, well, we don't even know if he existed. But from what I understand, if you go to a conference of professional historians in ancient history, you will not be able to find someone who actually thinks that Jesus did not exist. That is a fringe belief to the extreme. So you can take these, I'm going to call them facts. Obviously, 95% is still not a fact. But compared to what else we know about ancient history, these are facts. So Jesus existed. He died on the cross. Another one is that he was buried by Joseph of Arimathea. So that shows that he actually was buried in a tomb. The next one is, this is the one fact that is more like 50 to 60% of scholars accept, which is the tomb was empty. So that they, a group of women disciples, women followers, found the tomb empty. And then the other two that are more secure, that are like 95%, are that the disciples had experiences of the risen Christ after he died. And these could be hallucinations. Like, skeptics generally say they're hallucinations, but almost any skeptic, including someone like Bart Ehrman, who is one of the most famous American skeptics, he thoroughly believes that the disciples thought Jesus appeared to them. And in fact, to go back to if Jesus existed, Bart Ehrman actually wrote an entire book about Jesus existing to argue against the Jesus mythicists, as they're called. So anyway, the fourth fact that is often used is the origin of Christian belief. That the origin of Christian belief comes from a sincere belief that Jesus was risen from the dead. It was not a hoax, it was not a lie, that the disciples sincerely believed this, even if it was a hallucination. And that is the origin of this remarkable belief that kind of went against Jewish thinking at the time. Like, Jews didn't believe in a dying and rising Messiah. So one of the pretty sure pieces of data is that the disciples truly did believe that Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. And one reason for thinking this is simply that some of them died for it. A lot of them probably died for it. And generally, plenty of people die for something they believe in. They usually won't die for a lie, though. So that just shows that they were sincere. So what you do is you take these facts and you build a case for Jesus being who he said he was, the Messiah, the unique Son of God. My point here is not to build some case for Christian faith, besides simply saying what I just said, is to show how radically different of an approach this is. it's much more like the black swan thinking in that it's much less data. Like, you can, all these facts are true. Once again, please allow me to use the word fact, because all these pieces of data are secure. That would probably be more technically accurate, but I'm going to just call them facts because they are secure data of ancient history. More secure, I mean, people say this is more secure than, like, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, I've heard it said. So, you can take these facts, and they're almost universally agreed upon. This is very similar to the argument about global warming I mentioned in the last podcast, about you're using the data and the ideas that everyone already agrees on, which is that the weather is chaotic and complex. And so in this case, you're using what everyone agrees on, which is the disciples had these experiences, that Jesus was buried, that he legitimately died and wasn't faking it. The disciples didn't take him down while he was still alive or something like that. So you're taking very secure data and a minimal amount of it to build a case. And so from there, it remains to be seen, okay, is this a successful case? And people who are interested, I would say, William Lane Craig probably lays this out the most succinctly and the best in his debates. And the thing I love about his debates is you're often hearing a smart skeptic right there arguing against him, so he's not going to get away from with really obvious, obviously bad arguments, I would say. So I would definitely recommend checking out his debates if you want to hear it laid out a little bit better. But once again, my point here is to show how radically different this is, because all those facts are true. This is key. All those facts are true, regardless if the Bible is riddled with errors. The Bible could be riddled with errors, could be a completely human book, and that has nothing, that does nothing to the fact that Jesus died on the cross, that he was buried, that his disciples had sincere experiences of him alive again, and that was the origin of the church. It does nothing to that. And when I first came to that realization that I could move in that direction, epistemologically, it was just like that entire weight, that cloud, the spinning plates just evaporated, because no longer is that required. And skeptics, you know, use the term free thinking, and which I think about a lot, because I want to be a free thinker, and I think a Christian can be. I think really what it comes down to is loosening an idea to where you're holding it in an open hand and you can let it go. It doesn't mean you do let it go, it's just that you really are prepared to let it go. And so that's what happened with me with the Bible. Like, I just, it can go either way now. Whatever seems the case, if it seems like it's inspired, then I can believe it's inspired. If it seems like, from what I understand, it's not, then I'm free to do so. And ultimately, I got that way, even with my foundational beliefs about Jesus' resurrection and stuff like that, because I wanted to be free about those too. That's a whole other story. But my point here is just to illustrate a totally different path to take, which is much more conducive to the black swan sort of thinking. I realized one question as I was going through that you might have had is, if the Bible is riddled with errors, if that ends up being the case, then how can we even know those three or four so-called facts? And the answer is by using the exact same tools we use on any other ancient document or any document, period. And that's the tools primarily of textual criticism, which is a field that developed over the past couple hundred years. And Bart Ehrman, the skeptic I mentioned earlier, is one of the foremost textual critics. And that's why it's powerful when he also affirms the three facts that are so secure. And just to give an example of some of those criteria they use, some of the tools, two of the most obvious ones and strongest ones are number of independent sources for a particular story, particular event, and how close to the event the sources were written down. So, for instance, I believe the resurrection narratives, where the group of women followers find the empty tomb, it's either that or the appearances of Christ are, I believe, have six independent sources, which is remarkable for something 2,000 years old. And as far as the time gap, there one of the earliest things we have is Paul passes on a tradition he received in 1 Corinthians 15 of that Christ made these appearances, the risen Christ. And Bart Ehrman, once again the skeptic, dates this tradition that Paul has as going back to within 5 years of Jesus's crucifixion, which is mind-blowing when you compare, once again, compared to the idea that this is 2,000 years old. So those are some of the criteria they use. Another, I think this one is really interesting and clever. It's called the criteria of embarrassment. So if something in the source would be embarrassing for the author to put in, it makes it much more likely that it's true. And a good example of that is Jesus saying that he doesn't know when the second coming will happen, because that makes it seem like, wait, I thought Jesus was God and omniscient, but that makes it much more secure that Jesus actually did say that. So anyway, that kind of gives you an idea of how the source material could have plenty of errors in it, but because of the advanced tools we have, including statistical analysis and vocabulary, like they use vocabulary analysis and style analysis to figure out if it's the same author as another letter and stuff like that. There's really cool advanced tools. In fact, I've read three of Bart Ehrman's books, and one of them is called, I believe it's Misquoting Jesus, that the first half is practically an introduction to textual criticism, and I would recommend it. It's really good. So anyway, that kind of gives you an overview of how that sort of works. And next time, yes, next time I will be talking about software engineering and how that applies to epistemology, and how really I found a different avenue of coming to the same sort of black swan ideas through that. So I will see you next time. Ahoy.